This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we are talking with Tyler Kotesky. He's an education analyst and researcher for Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes The Reason Podcast, as well as Reason Magazine, Reason.com, and basically everything else with the Reason brand. This is also National School Choice Week, which is an annual event that celebrates the depth and breadth and just variety of school choice around the country. Reason is a national media partner with School Choice Week. The people who celebrate this, there are literally tens of thousands of events happening all over the country. If you go to schoolchoiceweek.com, you can find a list of events in your state and probably even in your own town. There is well over 20,000 events happening during the course of School Choice Week. Tyler, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Pleasure to be here, Nick.
You have in the current issue, the new issue of Reason Magazine, a story that is called Micro Schools, Are Micro Schools the Next Big Thing? The Promise and Peril of Tiny Private Schools. Let's talk about that during School Choice Week, especially. What are micro schools and why should we be excited about them?
So I think the best way to describe micro schools is probably just thinking about them as kind of like a revived one-room schoolhouse, set into the 21st century. So there's a lot of it's not really a hard and fast definition, but some of the features that you usually see are that it's a small size. So you have anywhere from maybe even just half a dozen kids to under 150 is kind of the upper limit a lot of people use. The kids tend to learn in mixed age groups, so there's no age-based grades usually. And the teachers kind of function more as these guides who are helping you kind of discover the learning yourself rather than these sages that are all-knowing and telling you the content directly as we're kind of used to. And there's a big emphasis also just on digital content and sort of personalized learning through projects and things like that.
So and I don't mean to, shortchange or reduce things in a bad way, but it's almost kind of like Montessori meets Silicon Valley. It seems very individualized, very personalized. You're roaming up and down in age ranges, and the kids seem to be doing, from your story, and we'll talk about a couple of the specific schools that you discuss and that you visited for the story, but they do a lot of projects or tasks. So it's experiential learning. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. And like you say, there have been schools like Montessori's and things like that before that also have kind of similar non-hierarchical models. And I think, yeah, the main difference is that there's a lot more technology and I think kind of forward-looking focus in a lot of these.
So let's talk about one of the schools that you talk about, which I guess was in New York City. It's called the Portfolio School. What did you find there and what does that illustrate about the micro school movement?
So I think Portfolio School was kind of, in my view, sort of represented the top of the market in terms of the offerings that you can find in this pretty diverse movement. So this was in downtown Manhattan. It's in Tribeca, and founded by a former Intel employee and a filmmaker, and they were both Princeton graduates. And you walk in, and
I hate them already. Intel, science-based Princeton grads, but so you walk into the room and they were working.
Yeah, it's the first thing I noticed was that just the walls are all whiteboards, so they're all covered with these diagrams about the planets and different equations and everything. And the time that I had gone specifically, they were doing this whole Mars exploration unit. And so it was this big, long interdisciplinary unit where they're learning how to get to Mars because, that's something that engages the kids. But to learn how to get there, you got to learn about Newton's laws. And so they do things like go to the local playground and film each other using these apps that they could then you know, they go home or they go back to school and they see how when you're on a swing or something like that, you can see the laws that you're learning about in action. So they make a big effort to relate what they're learning in school to their daily lives so that it seems relevant, as opposed to just kind of being sat down and told, hey, just learn this because you have to accept that it's important.
So how do they, you know, with the age range and with the mixed ages, which it sounds, you know, really kind of great because, you know, school is the one place in our life. And, you know, when we're 5 or 6 years old, we go to this place for the next 12 years and then another 4 or more if you go to college or grad school, where you're hanging out with people who are basically the same age as you. It's a very strange thing that we take for granted. But, you know, what is the age range, say, at Portfolio or a typical micro school? And what do you do with, like, like a 7 or 8 year old who can't really read that well, and then there might be somebody who is 15 or 16. How do they get engaged?
So with Portfolio School, they've been around, I believe, for about 2 years now, and so mm-hmm. they're still in the elementary school stage. So I guess it would go from about 5 to 10, and they break up the kids based on not age, but sort of their competency at various skills and things like that. Mm-hmm. So you might have a reading group that's taking more basic text and everything, and one that's a little bit more advanced. And because of their use of a lot of personalized learning software, they can have a decent sense of where each individual student is in terms of their achievement on just the core skills, like reading and math and things like that, to be able to then figure out where to place them in some of these differentiated lesson groups.
And then what happens, or where do the teachers come from? Because this seems like, you know, it's not just students who get regimented and taught a very kind of, you know, inside the box way of thinking about school. It's true that, you know, education programs churn out teachers who, you know, think of the students as widgets somewhat. Where are the teachers coming from at Portfolio?
So I know the sort of the head of their curriculum design and everything had a pretty extensive career working both in psychology and various lab schools and trying to pilot out different innovative learning techniques. And so it's clear that that philosophy was informing a lot of what they were doing, especially in kind of trying to make what they were learning relevant to their daily lives. And I know at least the two teachers who they call master educators, which I suppose in New York City, you got to try and differentiate yourself with a title
yes.
like that. But, you know, they've both been, had careers teaching for about 15 years beforehand at various different schools. So I think they both seem to, have a just general openness to trying something new. And that was kind of at Portfolio School and other places, it was, we've tried to do the new approaches that we've wanted in public schools or even traditional private schools. And it just hasn't been possible in those contexts. So we're trying something new.
How much does the school cost this one?
So it's hefty. It's about $35,000, which is a lot and is certainly not in reach of a lot of folks. But the important thing is your average private school tuition in New York City is about $44,000, and some of the more expensive ones are even topping $50,000 now. So it's a significant savings in context. But I think that's one of the potential drawbacks of the model is depending on where you are in certain cities, you know, it may still be out of reach for your average person without some kind of program like a voucher education savings account to help make it more viable.
Right. And do you know offhand, what does the New York City public school system spend per student? It's got to be north of 20 grand itself, right?
Yeah, it's I'm blanking on what the exact figure is here, but I can it is definitely in, I think about like, 15 or 20,000. So it's definitely, investment wise, is not getting a lot of ROI on that.
So then you talk about a place that's in Oakland, California. So it's the opposite side of the country. It's called Quantum Camp. What was interesting about Quantum Camp as a micro school for you?
So that one was, it was, I think, really innovative in the sense that it wasn't even necessarily a full school. They were just offering sort of STEM curriculum. So the science and math courses. From, you could do that from sort of first grade level, so, you know, ages like 7 or so, all the way up to high school. And it's just this guy who had taught in Oakland public schools for, you know, good 10 years or so, and was just totally disillusioned with the science curriculum, because he knew kind of implicitly what would be more engaging for his kids. Wanted to try it out, but just with the structure of, you know, the curriculum and union constraints and how you can teach things like that, mm-hmm. really didn't have the flexibility. So a friend bet him that he couldn't teach quantum physics to 12-year-olds. And, you know, he basically said, hold my beer, and started this school up. And so it's, I think the thing that is most interesting to me is that it also, a big part of their customer base are part-time homeschoolers who I think about, if I wanted to homeschool my kids, I would be very scared about trying to teach them physics or chemistry. And so to have a place where you can basically have all of your math and science content taken care of, you know, for $3,000-$4,000 is incredible, and in a way that seems to really engage the kids from what I saw.
And then you also talk about another school, the Acton Network of, I guess they're business schools or business academies. What's going on there?
So the Acton Academy was started by Jeff Sandifer, who also created the Acton Business School.
Okay.
Which, that's like a highly rated school on the Princeton Review type rating, things like that. And has already had kind of a non-traditional model of, they always, you know, fire the lowest rated teacher wow. every year and things like that.
A tough spirit rally at the end of the year. You know, it's, I don't know, you know,
a
I guess.
Hunger yeah. Game. You know?
Yeah, or Vice Principals, the HBO show. It seems, a little grim, but.
Right. But at least with Acton Academy, which is, you know, because the business school, obviously, that's the whole post-grad deal. But for
right.
Acton Academy, it's all this sort of, they have this philosophy of imbuing a sense of a hero's journey into their kids, and sort of the belief that they're seeking their passion and trying to find something that they can get excited about that's, you know, meaningful and productive to contribute. And for instance, but you see the philosophy of the business school coming through, because one of their defining projects is the Acton Business Fair that every school will do. And they basically tell the kids, all right, create a product and you're going to sell it to strangers on the street at this thing we have set up,
mm-hmm.
and you're gonna have to keep track of your costs and materials and everything like that, and we're gonna grade you on if you're ending up in the black or not. That's how real life works. And
the founder of the Acton Academy in Placer County, California, a guy named Matthew Bedreau, I might be mispronouncing his name, but he also says, though, that he thinks of himself as a, quote, creatively insubordinate, close quotes, and that's what he's trying to instill in his kids. Talk a little bit about that, because, you know, you don't really, typically you don't hear teachers or principals saying, you know, I want my kids to kind of be a pain in the ass.
Yeah, I think he's part of this theme of people who have tried to innovate within a more traditional educational status quo, and have sort of been rebuffed by the constraints of the system. So he was a he was a teacher and administrator in both public and private schools, and found the system sort of far too rigid, and was, you know, basically wanted to create a more non-traditional setting where kids would be just kind of more openly thinking for themselves, not just blindly accepting rules for their own sake. I know one of the things I like about Acton Placer from talking to Matt was their whole system of the students setting their own individual learning goals. And this is part of what I guess the technology enables when you can have this individualized software. So you could say, all right, I'm going to, you know, learn this many new words in Spanish or this new type of equation in math or something like that. And so the kids will kind of pressure each other in some ways to set high enough goals. And if you can sort of complete these tasks over time, you get Lion Bucks, which is, I guess, their mascot. And so you can use that to buy stuff. And so this one parent I talked to, her son, you know, was kind of more the spend it immediately type and got a pop socket grip thing for his phone, whereas the daughter was saving up to maybe buy like a pizza party for her friends or lunch with one of the teachers who they call guides and everything. So it's kind of a cool incentive system in the sense that, you know, you're not being afraid of harnessing self-interest in a positive way.
One of the really remarkable things about your story, which is in the March issue of Reason, which subscribers will have now, and if you buy a print or digital subscription, you would have it too as well by now. It'll go up later for free on the website in a few weeks, I guess, or whatever. But, you know, so that's a veiled subscription, an unveiled subscription pitch. But one of the things that I liked about the story a lot, Tyler, was your kind of thumbnail history of where, you know, why the American educational system writ large, whether, and this is true of, you know, most private schools as well as most public schools, we have a kind of factory model of education. And one of the things that's interesting about micro schools, not only their smaller size, so instead of talking about, you know, these regional or, you know, mega high schools that might have a couple of thousand students, you know, in three or four grades or something like that, but you have small classes of mixed ages. But, you know, it's the relative freedom, and it's that idea of, you know, the kids you're talking to here and the scenes you're describing. For somebody, you know, I went to high school in, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and The Wall, the Pink Floyd's, you know, concept album that was all about how shitty and repressive the British schooling system was, spoke to everybody because that's, you know, school was a drag. Talk about the, you know, where did the American model of education that we are slowly chipping away at, where did it come from? What are the roots of that? And what are the limitations of that?
So it's a pretty interesting story. If for folks who haven't looked into it before, for a country like ours, where we think of ourselves as this liberal democracy, sort of the default standards of our public education system came from Prussia, which was this 1800s German kingdom that was super militaristic, regimented, and authoritarian, and more or less were based on the system of public schools that kings there, such as Frederick the Great, set up with the goal of pretty much creating these like disciplined, dutiful citizenry who would make good soldiers and administrators and sort of embody the values of the state to serve the sovereign. And, you know, and a lot of people, especially in Europe, as you had the rising nationalist movement, saw education as sort of this key means of forging a national identity, you know, that didn't exist before, and sort of creating it out of thin air. And so how it got to translated to America was that Horace Mann, who's this famous 19th century,
the father of American education, right? Yeah. He's
indeed. Yeah. And so he goes and visits Prussia in 1843 because he's heard about this system and he thinks, oh my goodness, this is great. We can standardize everything and have great quality control. And so he becomes sort of the first Secretary of Education of Massachusetts and reforms the school system basically all along these Prussian lines to create what were called common schools, which were basically public schools then. And he thought this was an important part of, you know, assimilating those dastardly, Catholic immigrants into a homogenized sort of American civic identity. And so it was, people were worried that, oh, maybe these immigrants are going to have dual loyalty with the Pope or something like that. And so it was sort of to forge this baseline kind of a Protestant U.S. centric sense of civic values.
Right. So it's kind of to create a civic religion, really. To put a more kind of positive spin or a less dastardly spin on it, it's also, I mean, it seems similar to, the early Industrial Revolution, where one of the great triumphs was that mass production allowed, more people to feed themselves. But it comes at the cost of variety and standardization and everything. And you quote the educational theorist Ken Robinson, who has given, I believe you say, he has the single most watched TED Talk on YouTube. But he says we have an education model that is essentially built on the model of fast food, that everything is standardized, everything is homogenized. When did that model, which I think most of us recognize, unless, there was a period of a lot of experimentation, I think, in the late 60s and early 70s, which in public schools as well as private schools, that kind of faded away, but seems to be coming back. What is driving that interest in kind of moving away from almost a factory farm version of schools to these more individualized products? What are the drivers of that shift?
I think it's a change in just educational theory, partly, just because there's been a renewed interest in interdisciplinary knowledge and everything. So, for instance, Babur Habib, who is one of the portfolio school founders, he's working at Intel, and he's noticing that the people who are more successful there aren't necessarily the best coders. You have to be competent at that, but, it's people who can interact well with others and work in groups, be empathetic, be creative, things like that. And so as Tony Robinson, who formerly at the Harvard Innovation Lab, said, it's, the world no longer cares, how much you know in Trivial Pursuit. It's about what you can do and with the knowledge that you have to apply it in a useful way. And so I think probably a shift in some of the background theories behind that, and also just a cultural shift among parents. I think, like you say, with Pink Floyd and other people sort of talking about, we've seen this stagnating process in our public schools, right, where since the 70s, I think the total cost of educating someone from kindergarten to 12th grade has tripled in real dollars, and our sort of national test scores have been stagnant. So I think it's probably a reaction just against the status quo not working.
Part of when I was reading your story, I was moved to think of John Mackey, the co-founder and former CEO emeritus of Whole Foods. In a book that he put out a couple of years ago called Conscious Capitalism, he talked about moving past the Industrial Revolution model of, standard products in, or, standard ingredients in, and then you have like standardized products coming out, which is part of quality control and was very an important era of to pass through in industrial production of food and clothing and you name it. But you have the dean of Stanford Education School, a guy named Elward Cubberley, who in 1917 actually wrote that schools were, quote, factories in which the raw products, children, are to be shaped and fashioned into products to meet the various demands of life. And I mean, without saying this without any kind of qualification, but it seems like we've evolved as a society past that. We don't want to think about our kids as products As raw materials and then as products, especially if they're standardized and they're like everybody else. But how do we know then, and you raise this in your story as well, how do we know that this isn't a fad? And, you know, how many micro schools are there? What do we look for, say, in a couple of years to see if this is panning out or if it is influencing broader parts of the educational system?
Well, unfortunately, the answer right now is we don't know if it's going to be a fad or not, mm-hmm. and hopefully it isn't. And we saw one of the highest profile micro schools that was getting a lot of the coverage was Alt School, which had four campuses in New York and San Francisco. Started by a former Google employee, got tons of venture capital from folks like Peter Thiel, Mark Zuckerberg. In any case, lots of fanfare when they started, but over time they sort of got away from the schooling aspect and decided they wanted to go more into educational software. And there were some anecdotal parent concerns reported out about them not necessarily being attentive about kids falling behind and things like that. And so I think it goes to show that, and now they're closing two of their four schools as a result. And so I think it just goes to show that you can't rest on the laurels of having an interesting concept. You have to actually actively engage these parents, because by nature, anyone who's going to sign their kid up for something that is so different from what we've been conditioned to believe just is, has to be the default of how education is done, they're by nature going to be a risk taker. And so you have to convince them that the investment that they're making is worth it. And so I think in the micro schools that seem to be succeeding and hopefully will succeed in the future, it's about that parent engagement and feeling, making them feel like they're part of the process and able to easily track how their kids are doing.
Is, a lot of the action in school choice and kind of fragmentation and disruption of the public school monopoly, and public schools still, serve it's either around or a little bit over 90% of the student population for K through 12. Are any charter schools or public voucher schools doing micro schools or something like that? Or has this mostly been a product of private education so far?
It's a interesting mix. Some people see micro schools as being sort of useful pilot labs for practices that public or charter schools could adopt. I also know with Quantum Camp, for instance, there's a lot of parents who will have their kids in independent study charter schools, and Quantum Camp is listed sort of as a vendor that that they can use their funding for to get their science and math content. And Quantum Camp itself actually, it has started marketing out its instruction to other schools, which I think is a great way of, especially if we're going to facilitate a more dynamic education market, if you can just contract out the curriculum that you might not know where to get as good teachers for. It's lowering the transaction costs for new schools to spring up. So there's a variety of ways that people can access these courses and put more price points on more parts of education, which I think is ultimately how we get more choices and better quality.
Well, that, speaking of this idea of breaking down the kind of mental model of school, a school, you go to any town in the country and you know what the school buildings are because they all look basically the same and they all look a little bit like minimum security prisons or it's just, and it is so hard, even among kind of like radical libertarians, to break out of that mindset of saying, well, education, first off, it's not going to last from September to June. It's not going to last from the time you're 6 until you're 18. And it's not all going to take place at the same place. I mean, I love the idea of in educational savings accounts and a couple of other places where parents have an essentially almost unrestricted pot of money, and they can say, well, I'm going to send my kid to mornings at this language camp because that's good. And then, I'm going to send them on a trip because that'll be educational. And I'm using, dollars that are allotted and set aside for education. And to that idea of thinking so broadly and so differently than what we're used to, which is, you know, school is a place that you go and kind of nap from 9 to 3 every day, and then you get excited about 1 or 2 classes. You do something after school, et cetera. And I want to ask you your general thoughts on school choice. I mean, we seem school choice is growing. The number of charter schools continues to, you know, double and triple every few years. It is really hard to get out of that mindset in which we're raised. Where do you see, apart from micro schools, what are the parts of the school choice movement or the school choice reality that you see that are particularly exciting to you?
Well, I do agree with you. I think probably the education savings accounts represent just the leading edge of potential for where school choice could go in terms of being able to give every child sort of this individualized boutique experience, because why not? Especially if we can do it, on average, far cheaper than what the status quo has been in this sort of subpar standardized.
And kind of theoretically, an education savings account would be something that instead of a state or a locality saying, okay, we're going to spend $15,000 or $20,000 a year per pupil, that money or some portion of it gets put into an account that is, that the parents or guardian of a kid just uses to kind of stitch together whatever educational experience they want for the kids. And it can be, mix and match of all sorts of things.
Exactly. It really provides the ultimate flexibility for parent preferences. And because it rolls over each year, it gives you an incentive to actually save and spend the money on high quality materials and schools and things. So it almost helps produce its own sense of incentive for parent accountability. And, you could use it at your local public school or charter school potentially for certain courses if you thought they were providing them well. It's not necessarily anti-public
right.
education, but gives so much more options to people than they usually have.
Here's an offbeat question to talk about during School Choice Week and both acceptance of school choice, because everybody in every parts of our lives we're looking for more individualized and personalized experiences. We don't want to eat what everybody else is eating. We want our clothing to be personalized, et cetera. So it's coming to our kids' education finally. Two things. One is, what is the role of sports teams in keeping the public school monopoly and actually even the private school monopoly? Because, where I grew up in New Jersey, the sports powerhouse teams, particularly in basketball and football, were almost always Catholic schools because they could be single sex and they could effectively recruit much easier from all over the place than a local public school. How much is the sports culture that almost, the United States is almost the only industrialized country that has done this, where they fused sports culture and school culture and education. How big an obstacle is that to, just changing the way we think about school choice?
It's funny you mentioned that, because it is this sort of sleeper element that you might not think about if you're talking to a state legislature or something. You might think the only consideration is, oh, this is just going to be, cheaper, better quality, yada, yada, yada. But yeah, there's a lot of times where a legislator might think, well, if, the starting quarterback at my hometown public school has school choice, we might lose him to somewhere. And so, our team has enough experience in places where in states where this sports culture is a really big deal to sort of know that it's this implicit barrier in the back of some people's heads. So it is really interesting to see that pop up sometimes, even though if athletes had school choice, it would probably be better off for them, because
they'd
be able to go to a program where they could play more, whether or not they were star athletes or not.
Yeah, no, and I know that this is generally considered one of the reasons why Texas, which in many ways is, you know, is a great innovative state. It deregulates a lot of business stuff. It has, you know, it's good for business, but it's a relative laggard, particularly for a red state in school choice. And, you know, part of the blame gets put on the fact that Texas has a football culture where you'll get, you know, 30, 40,000 people turning out on Friday night for high school football. And you don't mess with that. You know, it also doesn't have the same tradition of kind of high power Catholic schools and private schools that would build a sports monopoly. Here's the other question, and this will be the last one that I ask of you, but does individualized education, you know, on the one hand, at Reason and in other libertarian and free market groups and individualist outfits, you know, on the one hand, we keep talking about how we want, you know, individualized education, individualized experience. We want, you know, we talk about molecular medicine where, you know, doctors should be treating people based on their, you know, goddamn DNA, you know, because everyone is different. And yet when it comes to higher education, we're constantly talking about snowflakes and people who, you know, students who can't deal with any kind of negative feedback or anything that seems to impose on their unique vision of the world and their place in it. You know, is school choice, our micro schools, our charter schools, our schools that cater to students' needs, are they creating, you know, a generation of like super duper snowflakes who will be fit for nothing in the world? Is there a tension there, or am I just being puckish by asking that?
I mean, considering the state of our college campuses, it's an important one to ask. I would say that I think if you look at the research on things like civic engagement, volunteerism, tolerance of people who don't share your political beliefs, they've done studies on students in traditional public schools versus in school choice options. So, you know, even just traditional private schools. And it shows that these students have better, quote unquote, civic values. And I think most importantly, in the sense that they are more tolerant of people who disagree with them. And in a micro schools context, though, I can see very much why, especially if there's more of an emphasis on working with others, thinking critically, being able to civilly articulate your viewpoints, especially when they oppose someone else's. I think there's a lot more of a culture of taking personal responsibility for what you believe and what you're saying than in the public school system, where I think it's much easier to, you know, just get by keeping your head down and completing the right tasks without actually having to have this journey of self-reflection that I think a lot of the places that I visited in the micro schools movement wanted to facilitate.
Oh, that's, you know, that's, I mean, it's a very convincing and compelling argument. And it's also, you know, very comforting to hear that. So who knew that individualism breeds respect for others and tolerance and an ability to engage people that you disagree with. And, I hope that's all true. I want to thank Tyler Kotesky. He is an education analyst at Reason Foundation. He has a great new story in the latest issue of Reason Magazine. It's called "Are Micro Schools the Next Big Thing?" Tyler, thanks for talking to me today.
It's been a pleasure, Nick. Thank you.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I am your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. And also, given that it's School Choice Week, go to schoolchoiceweek.com and check out all of the things, all of the events, tens of thousands, 20 of thousands of events happening all over the country, looking at the variety and the range of school choice options. Thanks for listening.